Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Yom Kippur, also known as the Day of Atonement, is the holiest day of the year for the Jews. Its central themes are atonement and repentance. According to Jewish tradition, God inscribes each person's fate for the coming year in a book, the Book of Life, on Rosh Hashanah, and waits until Yom Kippur, a week later, to seal the verdict. During the days of awe, between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, a Jew tries to amend his or her behavior and seek forgiveness for wrongs done against God and against other human beings. In the shtetls, the small Jewish hamlets of Eastern Europe, it was a custom for Jews to go from house to house, asking their neighbors for general forgiveness just in case they had wronged them during the past year. In the day before Yom Kippur, subtitled Sketches of Disappearing Types, Shalom Aleichem describes how three prominent shtetl characters behaved during the year and then on this special day. This is taken from the book The Old Country, translated by Julius and Francis Butwin, and published in New York City by Crown Publishers in 1946. Noah Wolf the Butcher. If the day before Yom Kippur were three times as long as it is, it would not be long enough for Noah Wolf the Butcher to finish his work in time for the evening services. And this is his work. He has to apologize to a town full of people for his year's misdeeds. He has to go to all the customers who buy meat from him, all the neighbors who live in the same street with him, or have their shops near his, or sit close to him in the butcher's synagogue. There is not a person in our town with whom Noah Wolf has not had an argument at one time or another. Not that Noah Wolf is such an evil person, but he undoubtedly has, as he himself says, an ugly temper. He simply has to fight with people. If you come into his shop for some meat, you're met with a pail full of cold water, and he cannot even tell you why. A housewife comes in. "Reb Noah Wolf, do you have any fresh meat today?" And he answers, "How should I have fresh meat? If you want rotten meat, you can get it." Or, "Noah Wolf, give me a good portion." And he answers, "I'll give you the kind of portion you deserve." Or this, "What kind of carcass are you giving me, Noah Wolf? Look at it." And he answers, "What does a carcass like you know about carcasses?" That is how Noah Wolf treats his customers, the housewives themselves. So how would you expect him to treat the servant girls? When one of them has to go to his shop, she curses her fate. She knows what a greeting she can expect. Either he'll slap her across the face with a beef tongue, or he'll fit her market basket over her head, or he'll simply chase her out. "Get out of here," he shouts. "Go to some other shop. There are enough butchers without me." Nevertheless, one thing has nothing to do with another. Noah Wolf the butcher may be stubborn and eccentric, and yet his customers won't go anywhere else because they know that he's the most honorable butcher in town. They know that his scale is true and that he keeps his word. If he tells you that the meat was slaughtered yesterday, you know it's so. And if he promises you some sweetbreads or a piece of lung or a calf's foot for Saturday, you can sleep in peace. The lung or the foot is as good as yours. Furthermore, he'll never connive with your servant girl to rob you behind your back, and he won't combine with other butchers to raise their prices. That is why the servant girls slander him and the other butchers would like to drown him in a spoonful of water. He sticks in their throats like a bone. He's a stubborn man. If he makes up his mind on anything, it's like an ox being dragged to slaughter. You can't make him budge. And he even looks like an ox. He's tall and broad and red-faced, and his hands are enormous. When he raises his cleaver to split a side of meat, he does it as ferociously as if the ox or cow had committed some crime and had been condemned to be chopped to pieces by him in person. That man is a murderer, they say in our town, and there are grown people who are actually afraid of him. But if all year long he gets under your skin, he changes with the coming of the new year. Then you would hardly recognize him. He becomes someone else, pious, God-fearing, virtuous, and sees omens in everything. He stops fighting with the other butchers, becomes soft as butter towards his customers, is considerate to the servant girls, becomes so unctuous you could almost spread him over a boil. Even when he chops his meat, now he does it differently, not murderously as before, but gently, mercifully. A different Noah Wolf altogether. The day before Yom Kippur, he locks up very early. He had said his morning prayers when most of us were still asleep. Puts on his holiday gabardine and goes from house to house to all his customers and neighbors, friends and acquaintances, to offer his apologies, to ask for pardon for the year's misdeeds. Gut Yontif, he says, happy holiday. If anything I have said offended you, I want to apologize and wish you a happy new year. And they say to him, the same to you, Noah Wolf, may God pardon us all. And they invite him to sit down, and they treat him to a piece of holiday tort. Ezreel the Fisherman. Since the world was created, you've never seen as ill-tempered a creature as Ezreel the Fisherman. An ill-tempered man with angry eyes, thick eyebrows, bristling mustache, and a beard that looks as if it's been pasted on. And he wears a quilted jacket summer and winter with the fringes of his talus cotton sticking out underneath. And he smells of raw fish a mile away. All week long you don't see him at all. But before every Sabbath and every holiday, he appears in the marketplace with his wagon piled high with fish. On top of the wagon sits a girl with a pockmarked face watching the fish. And his wife, Maita, a heavy, swollen woman, stands alongside the wagon with a stick and watches the fish. Fish, fish, fresh and quivering, women, fish for the Sabbath. That's the way Ezreel the fisherman announces his wares across the marketplace in his loud, familiar chant. And he never takes an eye off the women who have already crowded around his wagon and laid siege to it from all sides, clutching the fish by the heads, peering under the gills, poking at the eyes, or prodding at the bellies to see if the fish is fresh. These liberties Ezreel hates and despises like something unkosher, and he chases the women away. Away from here. You've pawed over them long enough already. This he hurls at them in a quick undertone. And then, once more to the world at large, in his loud, clear chant, fish, fish, fresh and quivering, women, fish for the Sabbath. Every woman, whether a housewife or a servant girl, is treated alike by Ezreel the fisherman. He watches her like a hawk. He doesn't suspect anyone of being a thief, but he knows that when it comes to fish, you can never tell. The richest, most honorable, most charitable woman is frequently torn by the desire to make off with a good, fresh fish if no one is looking. Fish, he says, is a temptation that's hard for a woman to resist. Every year, at least one scandal takes place around Ezreel's wagon. He slaps some woman across the face with a wet and shiny pickerel. From all directions, men and women come running up. There's noise and confusion. The crowd puts in a word for the woman, gives her advice, tells her to file a complaint with the justice of the peace, or have Ezreel dragged off to the rabbi. But since the pain is moral rather than physical, it soon wears off, and the whole affair comes to nothing. Most of the women know him already. They would think no more of edging too close to his fish than to the gold and precious stones under a king's guard. How much are your rubies and emeralds today? A woman may ask, standing with her basket at some distance and pointing with her little finger at the wagon. I deal in fish, not rubies, Ezreel answers proudly, without even condescending to give the woman a glance with his angry eyes. And once more he lets out his call to the world at large. Fish, fish, fresh and quivering. Women, fish. An apoplectic man, the women say of him. They would much rather not have anything to do with him, but that's impossible. There is not another fisherman in town, so what can one do? Lie down on the ground and die? Or live through the Sabbath without fish? But that's even worse than dying, for if a woman dies, she knows she's dead. It's all over. But if she comes home without fish for Saturday, then she has her husband's wrath to contend with, and that is worse than dying. I wish something terrible would happen to him. That is what the women say when Yom Kippur Eve comes around, and they rush off to the marketplace with their baskets, afraid that they might be too late, because the day before Yom Kippur, Israel is in the habit of getting up so early that God himself is still in bed. And when other people are just getting ready for their morning prayers, Israel is through with everything and is all dressed up for the holiday. His heavy quilted jacket has been put away, and he wears the coarse, shiny black gabardine that is seen only on the Sabbath and high holidays, but which nevertheless is saturated through and through with the odor of raw fish. Israel begins his fast earlier than anyone. Earlier than anyone, he comes to the synagogue that afternoon, takes his place close to the back wall, covers his head with his prayer shawl, and stands without rest for 24 hours. He won't sit down even for a minute. He prays quietly so that no one can hear a word. He weeps a great deal, but no one can ever see a tear. But that's in the evening. Before that, all day long, he goes around the town to his customers, bringing his apologies, asking their pardon. If anything I have said to you during the year offended you, I want to apologize and wish you a happy new year, he says. And they say to him, the same to you, Reb Israel. May God pardon us all. And they invite him to sit down, and they treat him to a piece of holiday tort. Getzi the governor. Getzi the governor. That is what we always called the shamus, the sexton of the old synagogue. Everywhere, in all the synagogues of the world, a shamus may be a shamus. But Getzi, the shamus of our old synagogue, is more like a member of the board of governors than a shamus. Did I say a member of the board? He acts like the president of the board. Getzi does not permit any secular business in the synagogue. He says that a synagogue is a place of worship. If you want to talk business, you can go to the marketplace. If you want to discuss politics, there's the bathhouse. Under no conditions will he let you talk during an intermission or a recess. Getzi is a man who shows no respect for anyone. You can be the holder of a pew by the eastern wall. You can have 17 silver stripes on your talus. He won't debase himself before you. You can be the richest person in town, Reb Joshua Herschel himself. If you say a single word out loud, you hear his hand come pounding down on the table and a cry of, quiet! So loud you're almost deafened. Or try to take one of the sacred tomes from the synagogue bookshelf and forget to bring it back in time. You'll be put in your place soon enough. Or if on the Sabbath you pledge a half pound of candles for the synagogue or 18 kopecks for the poor fund and then forget to give it, you might as well go bankrupt or leave everything behind and rush off to America. Or try to send Getzi on an errand that has nothing to do with the synagogue. This is what you'll hear. Do you have feet? Then go yourself. That's the kind of man Getzi is. The only ones who dare to be impudent with Getzi are the small fry. Inquisitive youngsters, small boys barely learning their alphabet, mischief makers, pranksters of all kinds, these make life miserable for him. The things they do to him would make anyone shudder. They turn over the prayer stands when no one is looking. They let water out of the washbowl, tie knots in the towels, let tallow drip on all the holy books, and tear Yekum Perkon out of all the prayer books so that no matter which one you open, the prayer is missing. These little troublemakers shortened Getzi's life. They taught him the terrors of Gehenna. He kept constant watch. Maybe he would catch one of them in the act. And when he caught one, he evened accounts for everything the whole band had ever done. To emerge from his grasp with only a light bruise, a black eye, or an ear that was only partly pulled off, that was luck indeed. Getzi hated drawn-out affairs, worthless investigations, and formal trials. No matter whom he caught, a rich man's child or an orphan in rags, it made no difference. Getzi knows all about slapping. When you feel his hand, you behold your grandfather in paradise. A powerful man, from a family known for its strength, although to look at him you would have hesitated to give 2 broken kopecks for him. Lean, dried up, skin and bones. But his side locks were thick and black, and he himself was dark as a Tartar, with fierce black eyes, hollow cheeks, a crooked nose, and black drooping mustache. All these things taken together make him look either as if he was about to sneeze but was trying not to, or as if he had something to tell you but was keeping it to himself, or simply as if he were an ill-tempered evil man. The most evil man in town was what a lot of people called him. A worm-eaten, spiteful creature who knew no master and did whatever he pleased. If he wanted to open the synagogue, he opened it. If he wanted to shut it, he shut it. When winter came, you had to get down and beg him to start the fire. But when he did make up his mind to start it, you thought you were in a steam bath. Let some wandering pauper beg with his last breath to be allowed to spend the night in the synagogue. A synagogue is not a poorhouse, says Getzi, and drives the poor man out without a trace of pity. And when the high holidays come around, Getzi rules in the synagogue with a strong and ruthless hand. If he's conceived a dislike for you, you will never get his permission to let your son or son-in-law sit where you would like to have him. You can resign yourself to this. He will sit where Getzi wants him to. And if you go up to the trustees with your complaint, you'll get this answer. Go to the governor. And you know that what they mean is Getzi the Shamus. To his face, you will call him Getzi, but behind his back, he's the governor. It's like that all the time. During Sukkos, if Getzi does not bring the esrog to you on time and you complain, he says, "You can wait a minute, can't you? I waited longer for you." So once more, you bring your charges to the trustees, but this is the only answer you get. What can a person do with a governor? All year long, it's the same. Getzi provides the materials for all the holidays, candles for Hanukkah, noisemakers for Purim, matzah for Passover, and greens for Shavuos. Getzi runs the whole town, rules over it like a king. Like a king? Like a conqueror. All of us have to endure it. The only time when people dare to talk is on the Sabbath or a holiday at dusk, when we sit and wait in the gathering darkness for the evening services. Then we can say something. For a few minutes, we do not have to be afraid of the Shamus. We can talk freely and openly. And no matter what we talk about, we come finally to the Getzi captivity, which seems worse to us than the Babylonian captivity we've heard about. We ask each other, "How long? Till when? How long will this captivity last?" And that's as far as we go. What else can we do? We Jews have suffered under so many evil kings and governors. But there's one day of the year when Governor Getzi suspends his tyranny. Not a whole day, but a half day, really only a few hours. That is the day before Yom Kippur, right after the morning prayers and before people start coming for the high services, when Getzi once more becomes king. But during those few hours, he forgets that he is Shamus, forgets he is governor. He's dressed in his holiday best, and he runs from house to house, stops everywhere with these words, "If anything I have said to you at any time offended you, forgive me, and may you have a happy new year." And he gets this reluctant answer, "You too, you too." and they invite him to sit down, and they give him a piece of holiday tort. Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you, so please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is EnglishCorner@RadioSefarad.com. I'll leave you now with a Sephardic rendition of the Yom Kippur prayer, Ana Be Koreinu, from the CD Kamti Lahalel, published by Beit HaTfutzot, the Diaspora Museum in Tel Aviv. See you next week. Sure.